That dog washing mic. Hello, welcome to the Sprocket Podcast. I am Brock Dittus. I am your host, and we are simplifying the good life here and now.
Right here, right now.
That's me going off script.
I see that. I'm Aaron Flores. I'm not going to go off script. We're broadcasting from the People's Republic of Portland, nestled in the heart of Cascadia.
We are the show that brings you somewhat irreverent conversations about the intricacies of thinking locally, with a global perspective and enjoying the best that life has to offer along the way.
Covering day-to-day life, food, alcohol, bicycles and alternative transportation, arts and culture, communication and the internet. And today we will probably cover pretty much all of those.
That's right. We're in the room with Chris Smith, Transit God, and Matt About Town. Chris, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Yeah. This is... As I've been rolling kind of how I would introduce you over in my head, I keep thinking of Almost Famous, in which there's the guy on the roof that says, I am a golden god. So that's what you are in my mind.
I'm just a citizen who has a high tolerance for sitting in meetings.
That's it. That's a skill not to be taken lightly.
That's actually one that's pretty rare within our circle of friends.
Seriously, yeah, yeah. But thank you again for joining us. And Chris, of course, is far more humble than I would be if I had as many connections as Chris does. So thanks again for coming in. Looking forward to getting into the nitty-gritty of how the city works, kind of in total.
It's going to be fun.
Yeah. Right now, we may or may not be able to hear it, depending on how sensitive the mics are, but former co-host Brandon Rhodes is washing his dog Cedar in the shower just on the other side of that wall.
He said he rolled in something from the pits of hell.
Something foul, yeah.
Yes.
That's unfortunate. So I hope he gets clean. I hope he hope he feels better about life. I feel somehow that the dog is going to be disappointed that the smell is gone, but we all in turn will be very happy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm okay with that.
As I was walking up to the house, Candace is like, Aaron, whatever you do, don't touch Cedar. And she probably saw it on my face. She's like, oh yeah, never mind.
He's covered in filth.
Well, even if he wasn't, I wouldn't. I'm not.
You're not a dog person.
I'm not a dog guy.
Okay, that makes sense. I had a great afternoon yesterday. I went out to meet Tammy and Logan from Rowdy Kittens, and Logan's blog, which fails my memory at the moment. He has his own Smalltopia, something like that. Are you going to the internet to find out?
I am.
If you want. But yeah, no, they were in town for a little while and said, you know, hey, we got this thing going on. We're meeting up with friends and whatnot, and you want to go and have beers. And I'd never actually been to Widmer before. So we had beers at Widmer, and I am impressed. I was actually going to make this same comment about Sam Adams, Samuel Adams, the brewery, because well, let's introduce our drinks now, Chris. You had said
we have theme beers for the comp plan, because the comp plan is a long process. It's actually occurring over the tenure of two different mayors. We started with Mayor Sam Adams. We're going to finish with Mayor Charlie Hale. So we have beer selections to honor both of them.
That's right. Yeah. So Sam Adams is our beginning, because that was the first mayor that we had. Popped open this bottle of Stony Brook Red, which is a unique Belgian-style red with a hint of tart fruit and toasted oak character, according to the classy bottle.
Toasted oak.
Toasted oak, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool. I don't know that I've ever had toasted oak.
I don't think I've had regular oak.
It's not the sort of thing you sit down in front of the TV with or something. So we have this in a little fluted glass, so as to enhance the aroma. So we're having that. And then there so happens to be Hale's Ales, at Chris's suggestion, coming out of Seattle, Washington. And they made a barley wine. So what I was going to say was, is Samuel Adams better than I remember? And is Hale's as sweet as we hope it might be? No, I actually don't have a lot of beef with Sam Adams, the mayor. Sam Adams, I know he's a controversial figure, but I really appreciated his focus on bicycle transportation.
Mm-hmm. Word.
He talked a lot about it, and some people say talk is just talk. I say talk makes people think, and talk is good. So,
no, yeah, it gets it out there in the discourse.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I very much appreciated Sam's leadership on a variety of topics, including this. I mean, I know he didn't make friends with everybody in town,
right?
But he advanced a lot of causes that I care a lot about.
Yeah, and when you're the mayor, you're not there to make friends. You're there to get shit done, so... Yeah, I'm into that. So we're doing that. And then, Aaron, you have?
I have, thanks to you, a bottle of cheer wine.
You want an opener?
Yeah, I think it's a twist.
Oh, it is?
Still use the opener.
Old-timey sodas in twist-top bottles. So I got to try this red here. Anyways, what I was going to say was that I've only known Sam Adams beer from my time in Boston, and I've only had their lager, as far as I remember. Not all that great. Good toss, sir. Thank you. I haven't particularly cared for Sam Adams beer, but this thing here, I didn't know they made stuff like this. Mm. And I think that's often the case. Like, most breweries that have a bad reputation as, like, you know, it's not a great beer, or it's just so-so or whatever. Like, people don't get excited about the flagship brew.
Right.
Kind of like New Belgium. I've never really cared that much for Fat Tire. And Fat Tire, of course, you know, it's a bicycle-themed beer. It's got the classy bike on the label and everything. But at the same time, it's just an ale. Like, it's not, there's nothing to write home about.
Right.
It's enjoyable, but it's not like my favorite or anything. But then when I went to their brewery, they have all these secret brews that they make that they don't distribute that are amazing. So, same thing with Widmer. Widmer had like a flight of stouts. I had three different, Russian chocolate stouts yesterday, I think. Amazing. Very good. And Sam Adams has, Samuel Adams has this amazing oak, toasted oak beer. So, I think this is going to my head already.
Did you not eat today?
You know, all I had so far is a bowl of oatmeal, so.
Oh, that might do it.
This is going to be a fun show.
Yes.
Anyway, and then we're going to pop open the barley wine at some point whenever we get ready for it. Chris, you say the word. Whenever you're ready for that, we'll pour it out. There was one more thing that I was talking about. Oh, my bike needs some
Your
work.
Your bike needs some work.
So, in a serious way, yeah. I have it scheduled now at VeloCult. VeloCult, right. my new favorite bike shop in town. I've never actually had a full professional tune-up done to my bicycle. I've always been able to coast by on, you know, whatever stuff I can do.
Yeah, you kind of tinker around on it yourself.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, I'm not very confident in my own abilities. Like, I know how to do a couple things. And if I'm out touring, like, in the middle of nowhere and no one else is able to help me out, like, I just learned how to replace a spoke last summer when a spoke broke and no one was there to fix it for me. So I said, well, I got him here. I brought him for this reason. Better figure out how to do it.
Let's do this. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but if there is a more talented mechanic than I around, I would much prefer that person to do work on my bike. So I broke down, bit the bullet. I'm going to get the entire tune-up done to my bike, and it's sorely in need of it now.
May I ask how much something like that would set you back?
Well, I think the standard tune-up, assuming that nothing else is really wrong with your bike, is about, I think that's Cedar flapping his ears in the background there. That's awesome.
I thought so, too.
The standard tune-up is about $70, $80, something like that. But my bike is going to be well over 200, about 220 or so, because it's covered in shit. It's got all the road grit that you get on your bike when you're in Portland. It's also, I've worn down the rear cassette. I have not changed the chain, as far as I can remember, since the last time I had bike work done, which is about this time of year last year.
Yep.
So that chain went all the way down to Colorado with me last summer and came back, and I've used it for my regular commute. And yeah, it's severely stretched. The cogs, the teeth are worn down on the rear cassette. It all just needs to be, yeah.
Well, and I found out just recently, like, someone who puts a lot of stress on their chain ends up wearing the rear cog much faster.
And I do put a lot of stress on my chain.
And, yeah, I mean, you're a big dude.
You
tend to ride in higher gears, too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. Adele and I were talking about that. So the reason that this is on my mind more prominently is that I have lost my front derailleur. Like, I used to have three chain rings in front. They're still there, but the cable snaps.
The cable, right.
And since I've already got the work lined up, I'm like, screw it. I'm going to ride with it as it is. That means I'm doing a lot more spinning. I'm in the middle chain ring. And so my legs are going way faster than they usually do.
Sure.
It's a better workout. And apparently better for your knees, better for the wear on the bike now, you're saying. So
yes.
Yeah. So maybe I should spend more time in that, but I tend to like pushing a little harder and spending
like
a little less. Yeah, are you?
Yeah.
There we go.
A grinder.
Well, we can stand in solidarity, Chris. You and I
had Bike Gallery do my bike in September, and they replaced the chain and then the rear cassette, and it was about $275, I think. So,
right. Yeah. Sometimes I think about, like, is it worth getting all the new parts? Like, should I just start putting money away now and buying a new bike sometime in the future? I still like my bike a lot, so I'm willing to put the stuff into it, you know. But sometimes I wonder.
I had this plan one time back when I was owning a car that whatever work, like outside of regular maintenance, whatever work I put on the car, I would match that into like some savings account.
Oh yeah, like double. double protection.
Right, right. Well, and then that would go to buy the next car, right?
There we go.
Yeah, that didn't last long.
Circumstances change.
I need new wheels? What?
Well, fuck.
I can't put $800 down in there.
Totally. Just one, a few more things related to technology and whatnot. Our website is up. And actually, I did a little short interview with Colin from thepodcasthost.com. He's our new web host, holding all of our information and data, disseminating it to the world from Scotland, Edinburgh. He's a cool guy. So at the end of the show, once we're all done with this, I'm going to insert a little conversation that we had about 5 minutes, just talking about web hosting and mountain biking and that sort of thing. He's a cyclist himself. Yeah.
Nice.
For some reason, I didn't think that Scotland had mountain biking access, but I mean, there's hills and trees and yeah, exactly. So you might as well. So that's me again, showing my ignorance, but glad to have Colin as a web host. He's a cool guy and loads better than any of the other services out there. So, we got comments open again. I think we might've referenced that last week or something, but,
we had
a problem with comments. People couldn't leave them and, that got fixed, so now you can leave comments again if you want to.
Please,
we've got some of the at least one of those in the mail segment coming up.
Cool.
And iTunes reviews. It's not like we're trying to do this professionally. It's not like we live or die by iTunes reviews. But if you do like the show and you have not yet written a review for us, you know, put it up there. That helps iTunes see that people are actually listening to the show. They like the show. And it might help us get some more attention if you want to help us get some exposure. So we covet your reviews, and we'll read them on the show if they're nice. If they're not nice, maybe we'll read them anyways. That might even be more entertaining.
Yeah.
Did you hear about Ellie Blue wrote this everyday cycling book, which I have yet to order. I want to order it and read it. It's, from what I hear, quite good. But Chris, did you hear about she's been doing this one-star review
Amazon,
thing?
Yes.
Yeah. One-star reviews, apparently, they're very entertaining.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. And it's a great way to get some attention to your product because, like, you know, everyone can get like, oh, it was a great thing. I loved it. 4 stars, 5 stars, whatever.
Sure.
But if something just gets a shitload of 1-star reviews, that's something you don't see very often. It kind of sets it apart from the sea of other products available out there.
And somehow that moves your product?
Yeah, I think it might help. It at least, you know, makes it, it has a distinctive presence on the internet.
Sure. Well, it's kind of a protest, right? I mean, I think the theory is that some of these review systems are a little bit rigged, and this is a little bit of a protest to say, you know, we're not going to play that game.
Exactly, yeah. And one of the ones that she pointed out that I thought was particularly entertaining was like, I couldn't ride this book at all. It didn't roll. It didn't even have pedals.
Nice.
Yeah, so something like that. So there's that. Shall we do some headlines?
What the hell?
All right. Let's do it. Give me just a moment. I reformatted my iPhone the other week. I was having problems with it, and so I decided to do some stuff and fix it. But that means I have to download all the new sounds again.
Oh, no.
The headline sounder? Not yet downloaded.
Uh-oh.
There we go.
Oh, there it is.
Now it is.
What can compare with the thrill of a brand new bike?
I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. I like my bike, it's fast. It circles around the city lights.
Pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast as we can into the daylight. Pedal just as fast as we can into the night light. Pedal just as fast as the leg of the ladder. Your pedal just as fast as we can into the morning light. Pedal just as fast
as we can into the The Denver Post reports. This is a great article. Black Hawk, Colorado, which is famous for its ban on bicycling, is corrected by the court.
Yeah. So the photograph in this article has a picture of a no bicycling sign that greets people as they enter Black Hawk. And the way it's positioned, you might think that it's just saying no bicycle riding on the sidewalk.
Right.
But in fact, Black Hawk is the town in Colorado that was very famous for putting a complete kibosh, a complete ban on bicycle riding in the town. And I don't know that it was actually a universal ban. I think you could still ride bikes on like the back streets or whatever, but if I remember correctly.
Like within, say, the township limits or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. Basically, they didn't want bicycles on the main drag. As I understand, Black Hawk is home to a fairly popular casino, and bicycle traffic would impede the traffic in automobiles trying to get to this casino.
Oh,
and
right.
So they, a while back, just said, hey, no bikes in town. We're going to make that a law. And the Colorado Supreme Court, this is quoting from the article, has overturned Black Hawk's ban on riding bicycles, ruling that bicycles are a matter of state and local concern. Damn right they are. The court ruled Monday that town can pass traffic regulations, but said they must comply with state laws that require any municipal bike prohibition to provide an available alternate path within 450 feet. So if they're saying you can't ride on the main streets in town, they have to build separate infrastructure. which is actually kind of that's kind of a hoo-ha.
Yeah.
You know, like not only were you wrong, yeah. You were hella wrong. So, okay, here it is. 2009, the town banned bicycles from any street where community leaders felt safety and traffic were compromised.
That's just vague enough.
Isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that could be anywhere.
Yeah, totally.
Their jurisdiction.
Yeah. I feel like that's the sort of law that, it's wiggle room. It basically gives people the right to crack down on whatever they don't like. So, but without it actually being stated as such. But I'm happy to hear that, yeah, Black Hawk is now a much better place for for bicyclists, for bicycle commuters. And I had never actually looked at the map to see where Black Hawk is.
I was going to ask, like, how close you guys got on your trip.
We got fairly close. We never got to Denver. Last summer when I was on the road, we were down in Fort Collins. Then we crossed through Estes Park and over the Rocky Mountains, the Great Divide.
Right.
And so we left all of that stuff kind of behind. Lyons, which is also down that direction, is the home of Oscar Blues Brewing, which, Chris, are you familiar with Oscar Blues?
I'm not.
They make, I believe, Dale's Pale is one of their more famous ones. The one that I like is 1050, which is a 10.5% alcohol by volume, which is also this viscous motor oil sort of beer. It's a really dark, really sludgy stout, and just amazing. But we didn't get that far down. It's also Erie, I believe. Erie, Colorado is just north of Denver, another place we didn't go. And that is the setting, that's the principal setting for The Dog Stars, which is a book I just read, post-apocalyptic about a pilot who's, you know, one of the 1% of humanity that survived this big epidemic flu. So that was a great book. I recommend it
highly.
Yeah,
you were recommending that to me a few days ago.
Yeah, if you liked The Road, this is like The Road, but in Colorado and a little bit different.
Okay.
Instead of pushing a shopping cart, the guy's flying an airplane. So, yeah, but there's some really fascinating, like, you know, how weird humanity gets when everyone, it's like every man for himself. So, and it ended actually, the story ended in Grand Junction, which was the end of our bike trip.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
As I was reading this book, I had like all these memories of places that we either had been or were near. And it's kind of cool putting everything into context. So, well, that's the only headline that we have. So, again, I need to load our outro sounder. But Chris, any commentary on the Black Hawk bicycle ban being overruled?
I think I'm a little worried if we have to rely on the courts to enforce our rights. But hey, I'll take the decision.
There we go. Yeah, not optimum then, but it's a thing. Those are your headlines.
And riding a bicycle. You are now an operator of a wheeled vehicle.
There we go. And now. Now that we've gotten that stuff out of the way, yes. I have. I now have both choices available again. Chris, would you prefer a classic movie, sort of Hollywood's fanfare, or a more a royal fanfare?
Hollywood.
Okay, here it comes. We present to you Chris Smith of Portland Transport, the Portland Streetcar, and many other things. You want to give us the litany?
Sure. Well, the big one at the moment is the Planning and Sustainability Commission, which is something I've been doing for the last 3 or so years, and I have Mayor Sam Adams to thank for that. He was the one who appointed me initially. And we have been in the midst of some big, big efforts. The Portland Plan, which is the 25-year strategic plan for the city, and now the Comp Plan, which is the actual detailed ordinances that implement that. Big deal for the city. We haven't done one since the 80s, so we're due, and this is our chance to map out the next 25 years for the city.
Yeah, so it's every 25 years that they do something like this, or is there a stat?
There's a frequency required by state law, and the one we did in the 80s was the first one. You know, after all the land use legislation of the 70s, cities had to do comprehensive plans. This is our first update since then, and we're a little bit late, but the state gave us some slack because they knew we were going through the Portland plan process.
Okay.
So better to do it right than do it quickly.
Right, definitely. Yeah, you want to take your time. And this is it's a multi-part procedure. There's we're on the first draft now, is that correct?
We are. We're looking. I have a document in my hands that's about an inch thick, and this is the policy section draft. So the comprehensive plan actually consists of about three different pieces. There are the policies, which are kind of the guiding ideas. There are the system plan, so everything from the transportation system plan, you know, how we assign categories to different streets, to, you know, the sewer plan, the water plan, all the different sort of capital pieces of the city, and then the maps that control the zoning and sort of other policy implementation things. So be over the next year or so, we'll be putting all that together and then forwarding it on to City Council.
Yeah.
But the policy draft just came out, which is why I'm excited to be here talking about it.
There we go. And this is, I think, when you were on Portland Afoot recently, it was last month, I believe, that you you kind of talked a little bit about this. And they called that their wonkiest episode ever.
Well, let's see if we can surpass them.
We have a bit more time than they do generally, so we can milk that for all it's worth. But yeah, this is going to be we'll talk a little bit about urban planning, about how you integrate stuff. Some of the things you had earmarked were obviously there's some bicycle access stuff that's going to be very intentionally incorporated into the plan. Centers, as far as like creating neighborhoods and creating places, which I can't think, I'm sure this is on the table and on the radar for other urban planners, but when I think of people making decisions, I don't necessarily think of them saying, hey, everyone should be like within walking distance of a store or something like that. So, and maybe that's just kind of a caricature or like a cartoon of what they're actually doing here, but just in summary, I'm proud that it's on the radar. So
yes, and I think it's one of the critical pieces because you know we can build transportation infrastructure all over the city, but if there's no place to go to, it's not very useful.
It's a bike lane to nowhere,
right? And you know we're here in sort of the edge of outer East Portland, and I think a lot of the challenges with East Portland are that when it was annexed into the city, it was zoned pretty much 100% residential, so there wasn't a lot of thought about how to provide services. Commercial or otherwise, it's you know, deficient in parkland and some other things. So really one of the key questions for this iteration of the comp plan will be how do we bring some of the quality of life to East Portland that we have in the old streetcar neighborhoods where we've got you know a good grid, good commercial streets so that there are those places you can get to relatively quickly. You know, the a couple of the policies of the comp plan say that we'd like to make walking the preferred mode for all trips under a mile, and we'd like to make cycling the preferred mode for all trips under 3 miles.
And that seems very unique to urban planning. I mean, I'm sure there are other people that have had ideas like that before, but would you say that's like something that's kind of unusual for the U.S.?
You'll see language like that in some European plans. You know, the Netherlands has language like that, and Vancouver, B.C. has some similar policy ideas, but I think we're out there in the United States leading the way on this. But again, those don't work unless you have places to go to. And I think in East Portland, I think some of the questions that are going to come up is how do we make Lentz, you know, a place that hosts a wide diversity of services? I mean, it's it's already a little bit of a center, but I think the potential is there to get a lot more vibrant. And we need to figure out how to make that happen. Same thing with Gateway. And a little further out, I think we're thinking about Division and 122nd should be a commercial hub more so than it is. And finding policies and public investment that will help make that happen will be, I think, a big key to improving livability in East Portland.
Excellent.
One of the things we look at in this process is something called growth scenarios. So, you know, what are the patterns of growth that are going to occur in the city? And, you know, if we sort of just let it happen, it's fairly dispersed.
Right.
Spread through, you know, sort of the existing central city, some of the corridors. Some of the centers that we, you know, are sort of already defined, either in reality or in policy, because reality and policy don't always match up. You know,
right.
People build things in places where we don't anticipate that they will, and they often don't build in the places.
Do you have any examples in mind of a place that kind of became a center or a place that might not have been intended to be?
Probably the best example is not in Portland proper, but you know, Bridgeport Village.
Oh yeah,
was not on any of the regional centers plans. But a developer came in and really made that happen.
Yeah, Bridgeport Village, for anyone who doesn't know, that's a large outdoor kind of town center-styled shopping mall.
Faux town center.
Yes. it's a town center surrounded by a parking lot.
Right.
But yeah, kind of what the new style of mall that's kind of becoming popular in which people get to stroll down fake main streets and there's torches lit and that sort of thing. And it's a huge commercial center in southwest. It's Washington County, I believe.
It's between Tigard and Tualatin. I don't remember which line.
Yeah, the southwest part of the regional area here. And we should probably say here at this point, we are going to talk a lot about Portland here. So if that doesn't strike your fancy, you know, I mean, it'll still be interesting. But just so you know, this is we're going to get only more specific as time goes on. So listeners outside of the Portland area, just be advised.
Right. But, you know, going back to the idea of proximity, which is a critical one in the plan, you know, the Portland plan does have explicit goals. People should be, you know, so far from a center with a grocery store, within a certain distance of a frequent transit line. We want to get a large part of the population within a quarter mile of a neighborhood greenway or other, you know, comfortable bicycle facility. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's a big city, right? We got a lot of land area in the city of Portland, and You know, it's not like we can build a grocery store a quarter mile from everybody's house. So a lot of it is about where we locate future housing and trying to figure out those patterns. So whether we, you know, try and encourage more development downtown or in the central city, or if we, you know, try and stay inside 82nd where all the services already are,
right.
You know, there are some things that might be a lot more efficient in terms of dollars. But those would never provide the equity for the people who already live past 82nd. You know, we do, the city does go on another 80 blocks past 82nd.
It's fascinating.
Some people who live downtown forget that, but there's a lot of Portland past the I-205 freeway.
Right.
So we have to balance doing what's efficient with, you know, doing what actually brings equity, because that's another big theme of the Portland plan. Is we want the same benefits and opportunities to be available to all of Portland's population, not just people who happen to live in certain places. So.
Sure. Yeah. And that would be I'm trying to think of a good dumb guy's explanation of equity for people like me who aren't necessarily big on vocabulary. But yeah, just kind of giving opportunities and resources to everyone.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your chance to get a good education, your chance to breathe healthy air should not depend on where you live.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's the geographic definition of equity. We could also look at it by race, by income level, or a whole lot of ways to slice and dice equity. But, you know, it's about being fair, basically.
Right.
And how would you differentiate this from, say, like gentrification?
Well, you know, gentrification is, and I'll slice gentrification down a little bit. There are a couple pieces. Gentrification is technically when a higher income group of people move into a neighborhood and kind of move the average income upward,
right.
Which isn't always a bad thing because you know, services may follow a population like that. The flip side of that is displacement, which is when the people who are there who may be lower income get pushed out because rents go up or other things happen where they don't feel welcome anymore. And that's the downside. So you know, pure gentrification, just you know, new people moving in isn't necessarily a bad thing, but when it's accompanied by pushing other population out, that's a very bad thing. And it's tricky because you know, the way to not have gentrification is to not invest, right? And disinvestment is also a bad thing. I mean, that doesn't
then
produce equitable outcomes either.
Down.
Right. So the challenge, and a very tricky challenge, is how do you provide investment in a way that both pulls up the current population and also makes it attractive to other people potentially, but doesn't displace the current population. And a lot of it has to do with looking at housing tenure. So do people own their homes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you own your homes and property values go up, that's a good thing, right?
Sure.
If you're a tenant, maybe not so good, right?
Because
your rent's
rent
going to go up.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So so making sure that, you know, looking at home ownership rates, seeing if there's affordable housing in the neighborhood. So, you know, for example, we just did a plan for the Cully neighborhood, which is a really interesting place. It's a very diverse neighborhood. It's got pretty good social cohesiveness. You know, people are there because they want to be there. But it's also got a lot of affordable housing and a pretty high home ownership rate. But we were basically looking at the challenge of how do you get the commercial services in there, because it's definitely weak in commercial services, another area that was annexed and left mostly in residential zoning. So we were looking, where should the commercial nodes be? And also transportation connectivity, because Cully is famous for having basically big gaps in their street network where there's either a dirt street or there are no sidewalks.
Right.
It's the only kind of inside 82nd Avenue neighborhood where there's no direct bus downtown. It's kind of amazing. It's a really interesting place that's very hard to get to.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, because Line 71 kind of wraps its way around.
Right.
It goes to our neighborhood down here in Southeast.
Right.
And then it makes a big loop through kind of that central area.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't go downtown.
So you have to transfer somewhere to get downtown.
Yeah.
So there's a worry that if we make it easier to get there, it becomes more attractive as a place and we might, you know, wind up displacing people, which we don't want to do. So, you know, we were careful to assess that, you know, actually the home ownership is pretty good. There are affordable housing resources, organizations like Hacienda that have housing. So we think it's relatively resilient against some of the forces of displacement. But, you know, we have to pay attention to that. We can't, you know, just say we're going to invest, it's a good thing, and everybody will be happy, right? Because everybody doesn't wind up happy at the end of that process.
Sure. And that seems to be the, I don't know, the easy solution, or it's been in many of the cities that I've lived in. It's been sort of the way to do it. Like, this is a poorer neighborhood. Let's just throw some money into it. Let's just start investing into it. You know, you make it the cool neighborhood or whatever.
Right. And that happened with the Yellow Line a little bit in North Portland.
Sure.
We went in, I think, to some degree with our eyes open, saying, you know, we don't want to have gentrification, displacement, and we want to be planful about that. But the nature of the funding streams, basically, you know, an urban renewal district was created to fund the Yellow Line.
Uh-huh.
And just building the rail line consumed so much of the resources from the urban renewal district that there weren't enough to do the affordable housing programs and other things that might have buffered some of those effects. And so we got gentrification. So hopefully each time we do this, we get a little bit smarter.
Yeah.
And we now have with urban renewal, we have the 30% affordable housing set aside. So anytime we do an urban renewal district, 30% of the money comes off the top and goes to affordable housing. So
that's good news.
Hopefully we avoid some of those mistakes in the future.
I remember when the Yellow Line went in. The Yellow Line is Portland's north-reaching light rail line. There's the other one that goes to the airport, I guess, as well. But Interstate Avenue, I remember I was really excited when that was being built because in that time, I think it was like 2005 when they finished it. Is that right? Or
sounds about right.
More or less, kind of middle of the early aughts. And I used to live up in Vancouver, Washington, and my workplace was down in actually where the New Seasons is now. It was Oregon Armored Service. I was collecting change from parking meters on a city contract for that company.
That's right.
And I remember one day, I for whatever reason, my car wasn't working, so I took the bus from Vancouver all the way down Interstate Avenue. It used to be the old Line 5, which I believe there is no Line 5 on TriMet anymore.
That's right.
But it went down Interstate Avenue. Interstate Avenue used to be just this big four- or five-lane pockmarked road. It was amazing. And going there today, it's fascinating how much it's changed, just having had that experience and seeing it. But yeah, I just remember being excited that the Yellow Line might stretch across the river and I might be able to ride the Max to work. That actually wasn't the case. So
yeah, unfortunately, stretching across the river is now bundled with a $3 billion freeway. So that's,
right.
that's a place we probably don't want to go today.
Very controversial topic indeed.
The comprehensive plan is big enough for us.
That's right. CRC on another day.
Seriously.
So I do want to make a pitch for why people should pay attention to this, because we have a round of open houses coming up. We'll do another round in the summer when some of the other pieces of this plan are available. But, you know, I started out as a neighborhood activist in my neighborhood, and I think we probably all experienced that, you know, neighbors get upset about some project that's going up. And, you know, the developer may meet with the neighbors but say, hey, I'm allowed to do this. I'm going to do it. You know, there are a whole category of things that developers can do by right. Well, you know, when the developer talks about doing something by right, it's because it's within the policies that are in documents like this.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, this is setting the rules that people operate under for the next 25 years. And if it's in here and they don't require a variance to do something special, then they're going to get to build it. So
sure.
People really want to pay attention to what's in here because it, you know, it sets the framework for the rules for the next 25 years.
Right.
For example, if you don't want a Walmart to sneak into your neighborhood, right. Which, you know, it's pretty unlikely, but still, yeah.
Walmart, you want to pay attention.
Right.
Well, I mean, Walmart is doing smaller grocery stores now, so it may sneak into some neighborhoods in Portland.
That's true.
Right.
What do they call those? Is it the I can't remember.
They have a name. Something with local in it, I think. But,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyways, watch out for that sneaky Walmart then.
Right. So I hope people will participate. There are a series of open houses, and I will give a few of the dates here. So we are in Southwest Portland at the Multnomah Arts Center on February 19th. These are all, I think, roughly 6 to 9 p.m. in the evening.
Okay.
We're in North Portland at the DeSalle High School on February 26th. And we are in Southeast Portland at Franklin High on February 28th, David Douglas on March 2nd. That's a Saturday, so that's 10 to 1.
Actually stretching out to East Portland.
Yes.
That's good.
Oh, yeah. We make a point of covering all the city when we do these things.
I'm so proud of Portland for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's part of that equity thing.
Yeah.
Having access to the decision-making is a big piece of equity. You know, who has the ability to make decisions? And if we have time, maybe we'll talk a little bit about the composition of the Planning and Sustainability Commission because it is pretty diverse.
Yeah.
Let's see. Downtown will be at the Smith Student Union at Portland State University on March 5th. It's 5 to 8. Another Saturday session on March 9th at the Beaumont Middle School, covering Northeast a little bit. And I think there's one more being set up downtown for the business community that I don't have a schedule on yet. But if you want all these details, unfortunately, I didn't find a short URL for this. We used to have a great one for the Portland plan. It was just PDX plan. I don't think we've done that for the comp plan. But if you Google PDX comp plan, you will get to the first or second link will be the page that has all of this. So.
Okay, we'll put a link up on our post when we post the show.
We could try to find it ourselves and just link it on our page.
Yep.
It's so one of the Sprocket Podcast's greatest services to the community is offering links to other places on the internet.
Yeah. The quality you paid for.
That's right.
So this is a heads up to all the citizens. Pay attention because it's wonky, but it's important.
Totally. Yeah. Well, and it's funny how those things often go hand in hand. Like it's not, I mean, oftentimes the most important decisions are not, it's not the most pressing stuff. I'm trying to remember, I think Stephen Covey has some sort of diagram.
Difference between urgent and important.
Yes. Right. Yes. And urgent and important. And what's the other, either like... it's like whether or not you're thinking about it right now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, most of the important decisions are the ones that you don't necessarily – they're not like in emergency mode.
Right. And you don't want to make your most important decisions in emergency mode. You want to be reflective about it, right? So we're we're busy being reflective. Please come reflect with us.
That's it. hey, should we open that barley wine?
We could do that.
All right,
sure.
Let's do that.
Great.
Since it's here. All right. While I'm doing that you had made some earmarks on some pieces of the plan that you were particularly excited about talking
yes.
about today.
Let me go through. I talked about a couple, which are the the modal preference ones. Pedestrian trips for anything under 1 mile, bicycle trips for anything under 3 miles. A big issue in making that happen is giving priority when we design the street system, and there is a policy that. Was first reflected in the Bicycle Master Plan. And the way this works is that when we do this, we're rolling up all the sort of plans that have been passed in the interim. So, mm-hmm. Portland, since we did our comp plan in the 80s, we've passed a couple of Bicycle Master Plans. We did a Pedestrian Master Plan back in the 90s. We've done a Freight Master Plan. All those things get passed as resolutions by the City Council, which says, these are good ideas. We endorse these policies. But they're not actually binding. Ordinances are binding. Resolutions are, this is cool. So when staff actually has to go, design an intersection or design a street, they look at the resolutions and they kind of get, the direction policy would like to go in or council would like to go in. But they also have to look at the ordinances. And the ordinances are the, you must or you must not kind of rules. And the existing policy does not give modal preference to bicycles or pedestrians particularly. Hmm. And that would change here. We have a policy called the Green Transportation Hierarchy. It's initiated in the Bicycle Master Plan, but it's now in this policy draft. And it basically talks about a hierarchy where you start with pedestrians. The next tier down is bicycles, transit, and freight. And then single occupancy automobiles are at the bottom of the hierarchy,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of turning things upside down from the way the world works today, right? So this is really, really critical. I expect there are people who are going to criticize this. So we also need citizens to come out and remind our policymakers why this is a really important idea, mm-hmm. To make the city healthier, more humane, more environmentally sound, help us fend off climate change.
Right.
These are kind of the big ideas that are in the comp plan, and that hierarchy and priority is a really, really key one.
It's fascinating to see that in public process at this point, just because, like you say, it's not something that happens. Like, usually single-occupancy vehicles are on the top of the hierarchy, and everything else, pedestrians kind of get the short shift.
Right.
They get in trouble. So. Shrift, that's the word. I don't even know what shrift means.
Whatever it is,
short end of the, stick.
The short part of it is bad.
That's right. Yeah. That's a good barley wine, by the way. This is Hales Ales, and it's Rudyard's Rare Barley Wine Style Ale. So it's not actually a barley wine. It's an ale, but it tastes like barley wine. It's really sweet.
It is. It's very nice. And here's to Charlie and his success.
Seriously.
We carrying this plan over to the finish line.
That's right. By the way, how's that cheer wine, Aaron?
Ah, that was very sweet, and apparently doesn't contain any water.
Really?
I happened to glance the ingredients is as follows: real cane sugar, artificial wild cherry, and other natural flavors.
Well, there you go. Congratulations! It's got to be good for you.
A waterless soda.
So good. So let's see. After the hierarchy, I was thinking one thing that was striking to me in the proposals was the idea that if you reduce single occupancy vehicles, freight gets a better shot at using the roads and actually improves business, which is something I had not thought about, but it seems like it could actually be very true.
Yeah, you take an organization like the Swan Island TMA, Transportation Management Association. I think TMAs are something you're going to see a lot more of in the future as we start having groups that focus on improving the transportation situation in local areas in the city. There's been one in the Lloyd District for a long time. There's one in South Waterfront now, and they're starting to spring up. But you give local focus to how you make things better. Mm-hmm. So the Swan Island TMA basically sees their job. Yes, that's a big industrial area. A lot of freight goes in and out. Their job is to get cars off the road so there's room for the trucks.
Right.
So, you know, they've done a lot to, you know, get better transit service down to Swan Island. They're, you know, they're part of the North Portland Greenway Trail, you know, advocacy to get right. better bicycle connections down there. So, yeah, I think that's a really important piece of it. I think the freight folks are finally starting to get the idea that, you know, joining with the SOV advocates to argue for bigger roads is probably not their path to success. they may do better joining with the, you know, the bicycle and pedestrian advocates to make some space on the roads.
That's fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. That seems counterintuitive in a way. Like it seems in the past anyways, they've always partnered with the car people and the highway people.
Right. Well, I think, you know, part of the reason for that shift, and it's just beginning to happen, but I'm hopeful for it, is that there's a recognition that there really isn't space to build more roads. And there isn't a lot of money to build new roads. I mean, there's still a little bit, and there's some efforts. You know, we just passed a widening plan for the section of I-5 that goes past the Rose Quarter.
Okay.
But it's that's $400 million. It's unclear to me where that money is going to come from. But we still have some of those aspirations in our plans.
Such a common complaint.
It's nice to dream.
but, you know, there are other ways to get at it. And I think, you know, the comp plan will very much reflect the city's view that, you know, shifting to other modes has lots of corollary benefits. You know, mm-hmm. not only does it, you know, make the road system more efficient, it has health benefits, it has environmental benefits. You win on so many different levels.
Yeah, for sure. And one of my natural reflexes, just because like I'm a big fan of replacing motor vehicles with bikes, I think that's a great thing. So a natural extension of thought for me is to say, like, you know, yeah, screw those big trucks driving around. They're the right. worst. But where do my brake pads come from? They show up on a truck.
Sure.
Who's
delivering that new cassette for you?
Exactly. Showed up on a truck. Yeah. Like you can't get away from that. Like freight distribution, and we all use freight, whether we like it or not. So figuring out how to do that with a less with an impact that's not as harmful to us and the city and the region in the long term is a great thing. So
right. Yeah, the city just did a little work group that I was part of on sustainable freight. And, you know, there are a lot of pieces to it. It's kind of interesting the things that affect that. Obviously, the vehicle fleet is important, and, you know, moving towards electric trucks for some applications will be a step. A lot of it, you know, is that last mile stuff. It's the UPS mm-hmm. truck coming to your door and making that process efficient. And one of the things I learned out of that that's a little bit counterintuitive is the most efficient and sustainable truck is a full truck because what you don't want is to have a truck go out and make deliveries, and because it's so hard to deliver, you don't have access to the buildings, whatever, that you can only deliver half a truckload's worth in a day means you have to put a second truck on the road.
Right. You know, so now you're burning twice.
Right. So a lot of the things that make freight more sustainable are actually things like loading zones and policies about how we make it easier to deliver faster. So that was a wake-up call for me.
Definitely. And there's also just using vehicles to their greatest capacity. I remember mm-hmm. when Franklin Jones from Beeline, the trike delivery service here in town, had talked about taking something out from the central city core and then like picking something up on the way back in so you're not wasting the trip. Like, mm-hmm. And you can do good things with that. Like I remember he was saying, I think like something that would otherwise be like food waste ended up being usable food for mm-hmm. like charity programs and that sort of thing because they were able to take it from one place to another. So, yeah. Figuring out the logistics of freight and making that, fascinating just how much thought can go into it.
Yeah,
because that's something I don't think about it that much, and I assume most people don't.
Yeah, no, there's a whole field of computer programming that's just about efficient routing and all of those things. It's a fascinating area.
Yeah. Right. Do you want to talk about bicycles a little bit?
I'd be happy to talk about
some,
bicycles.
There's some stuff in there that I think that you had also flagged. What came to your mind as being particularly salient?
Well, I think, you know, the big one is the create conditions that make bicycling more attractive than driving for trips of 3 miles or less, because mm-hmm. that will really drive a lot of infrastructure design for us. Yeah, the one of the key pieces in here is the concept of civic corridors.
Yeah.
So those are the streets that are kind of the big major streets that everybody uses for some reason or another, that all the modes use. So you think about, Sandy, 82nd, Foster. These are the streets that sort of provide the backbone for, the non-freeway road system in Portland. And, if you look at the city's existing comprehensive plan, the transportation system plan that's part of it, they typically have all the classifications, right? They're classified as a freight street. They're classified as a transit street. They're classified as a major auto street. They may carry a bicycle classification. Typically, there's no bicycle improvements yet. So I think one of the questions we're going to have to answer is, how do we make those streets work for all modes? Mm-hmm. So, and a civic corridor doesn't have to be one street. It could be a set of parallel streets. So for the street like Sandy, the question will be, are we going to put protected bike lanes on it, or are we going to build a bicycle facility parallel to it? Well, that's going to be hard because Sandy's a diagonal that cuts across the grid.
Yeah, so parallel to diagonal.
It's not like there's another diagonal street that runs 100 feet away.
Bicycle skyway? But...
I've heard stranger things proposed.
Well, I'm trying to remember if it was an actual thing. I know there was a concept that someone had suggested of like buried bike lanes, bike lanes that go underground with a slight decline in either direction. So you could just coast to wherever you wanted to be.
Little bicycle subways.
Yeah. I don't know that that's very close to reality or possibility.
Probably not very affordable.
Yeah.
Right. Although you look at something like the High Line in New York City, and where you've got existing infrastructure, that's pretty impressive.
The High Line in New York City.
So that's a linear park that was an old. I don't know if it was freight rail or if it was an elevated rail line.
Yeah.
And it got decommissioned, and they turned the whole thing to a park. So it's a big linear park that goes from downtown Manhattan, sort of up the towards the west side. Been a big success.
Yeah. Oh, that I can't believe I haven't heard of it before. I got to check this out.
Uh-huh. But you probably wouldn't build it from scratch.
Right.
The infrastructure was there.
Yeah. If it was just for bicycling, it would be, there's just not resources to build something like that.
Right.
So there's civic corridors, and then is it neighborhood greenways? Is that the typical or the official name?
Yeah. I think if you think about sort of levels of bicycle infrastructure, we did a lot in the 90s and the early 2000s in basically adding bike lanes to arterials, mm-hmm. right? So just a little bit of paint that delineated area for the bike. And that captured the segment we call the enthused and the confident. So these
there
are
we go.
People who, I'm probably in that category, part of my commute is coming down from the Barber Transit Center, downhill on Barber Avenue, Barber Boulevard, with cars going past me at 50 miles an hour.
Yeah, that's a hairy stretch.
Not everybody wants to do that.
Right.
So we made a push starting in probably the mid 2000s to the neighborhood greenways, which we now what we used to call them bicycle boulevards. Now we call them neighborhood greenways. We keep improving our branding.
Multimodal. Yeah. You can skate down them.
Right.
You can skip. You can sachet. Yeah. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah. So they're basically, relatively low traffic, slower neighborhood streets that we make some improvements to make cycling easier, usually by making improvements where they cross arterials. So, think about Clinton crossing 39th.
I do that every day, and I'm so glad.
We've made it hard for cars to use the street there, but easy for bikes. Mm-hmm. So those sort of improvements. And what we found is that people love those.
Yeah.
And the segment of the population we call the interested but concerned, which are the vast majority of people.
And that's the tier below enthused and confident, right?
Right. So there's the strong and the fearless are like the 1%. The enthused and the confident are the 6%. And, really, I think we've captured that whole demographic. That's where the 8 or 9% of people who cycle in Portland come from. And you've then got 60% that are the interested but concerned. So if we give them safe enough facilities, they're going to get out there and use their bikes at least some of the time. Then there's 30% that are no way, no how, and we're just not going to worry about them.
Yeah.
But that 60% is the huge opportunity to get those 3-mile trips out of cars and onto bicycles.
If you can make it feel safer, if you can reduce some of the potential problems or dangers. Yeah.
Right. So a big part of the investment coming out of the Bicycle Master Plan and that we've been building the last couple of years has been expanding that neighborhood greenway network. And that's one of the Portland Plan objectives, is to get a neighborhood greenway within a quarter mile of everybody.
Okay.
And we're busy working away on that. But That won't address the civic corridors. It won't address some of the other major arterials. So the other pieces, there are actually two other pieces of the strategy. There's more off-street trails. So, you know, I had the opportunity to ride out here in Springwater today.
Sure.
Great. Not too many opportunities like that in town.
Not too many.
There are at least two more on the radar screen. We talked about North Portland Greenway is one.
Yeah.
And then Sullivan's Gulch Trail would be another.
Mm-hmm.
There's both of those have interesting opportunities to negotiate with railroads over right away.
Yeah, and railroads are—that's the sticky point in a lot of these negotiations—is saying, "Hey, can we put some asphalt and a bunch of bicycles riding through your property?" And oftentimes, the railroad says no.
Yeah, the railroads are pretty much only regulated by God, as far as I can tell.
They are the government. Well, and it's funny because before there were interstate highways, like railroads were like, you know, King Elephant, like they were on top of everything. They basically. You know, everyone needed railroads because, like, it was faster to get from one place to another. You didn't, you know, covered wagon takes forever. So the railways really did forge ahead, and like they were a huge financial concern in early America.
Right, and they got a whole bunch of rights from the federal government at the same time, which is what they're still sitting on top of.
Yeah.
So you know, off-street trails are probably the single most expensive thing we can do, but also one of the best things we can do. So that's a component of the Bicycle Master Plan. And then the tier in between is the so-called protected bikeways, which is something not a completely separated facility, but more than just paint, right? Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it might be
so a cycle. So it's something more than just a bike lane.
Right. So it might be, you know, a cycle track where you put the bikes curbside and have a row of parked cars buffering the auto traffic from the bike facility, or, you know, maybe we even put in concrete infrastructure that separates, but still on the same street. You know, we got the prototype up at PSU, essentially.
Yeah.
We did a fairly nice one on Cully Boulevard, if you ever had a chance to ride that.
Definitely. Only once or twice. The Sunday Parkways, which is the, you know, shut down the streets, the North American Ciclovia, if you will.
Right.
That has a bit of its route down that that cycle track, which is it's fun to ride on.
Right.
It's a long ways away from a lot of other stuff, which I think is probably like my principal. It's not like I'm mad that it's there. It's just like I wish I got to use it more often, but I never go through there. So,
Yeah. So, you know, so we have those tools basically in the Bicycle Master Plan. This 3-mile policy in the comp plan basically is the imperative to go deploy those tools to actually make it happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why that's a really critical piece of policy.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as far as resistance to that, it seems like. You know, obviously, finances are one thing. Public perception is probably another. What are some of the biggest barriers that you see? Like, if this plan is put in place, what are some of the things that might make that difficult to happen?
So here's one that's really wonky.
please go. We'll go for it. I should have had, like, a wonk sound effect.
Right. And that's the so-called level of service. So the traffic engineers basically have a metric about how congested the streets get, specifically how congested the intersections get, because that's
where
we measure congestion.
Here's a wonky sound. Oh, there it is. All right.
So right now, our level of service policy basically rates intersections from A through F, right? You know, A is what you get when you build the streets before you build the houses. F is when everything congests, right? But it only measures automobiles.
Okay.
Oh. So one of the things that this plan calls for is a multimodal level of service so that we measure either the amount of people that move through an intersection or maybe the amount of freight value that moves through an intersection because that's important too. But we don't just count axles because axles are the wrong metric, right?
Yeah. And right now, the only time that bicycles are counted, as far as I know, by the city is once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? And
yeah.
It's certainly not in all the places that people ride.
Every day on the Hawthorne Bridge.
That's another place I never ride, so I should think about that. Yeah, the bicycle counter is the sexiest new piece of infrastructure that Portland has had in quite a while. Everybody loves that thing.
Right. So, you know, with this new policy and with a better way to measure the productivity of the streets, you know, we'll have the ability to say that, you know, maybe it's okay if the cars get a little more congested, but we make room for bicycles.
Sure.
You know, we have not under policy had a way to say that. And I think that came up in the North Williams plan a little bit where, you know, in designing
the controversial North Williams plan,
but not for this reason.
Right.
Controversies around other factors that we ultimately worked through, which is a good thing. But, you know, in the end, the traffic engineer said, well, there's this, you know, 2 or 3 block section where we can't give you a dedicated lane. So we're going to have a shared lane between the cars and the bikes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really about how congested we can allow the auto traffic to be.
So, sure.
You know, the current level service policy would say that you can't cause, you know, the cars to back up at the lights. You have to find a way to get them through, even if that means that you have to make the bicycles more uncomfortable.
Ah.
So, you know, a better level of service policy, this new green transportation hierarchy, gives us the flexibility to say, well, maybe in this case it's better to make the bike's free-flowing and make the cars wait a little bit.
Yeah.
We have not had that option on the table before.
And I forget about Williams, just as an example, because Williams is fairly congested street when it comes to bicycle access. Right. Like, there's a lot of people using that.
Yes, we have bicycle congestion. We have, and the real safety there are two safety risks, at least two. One is bicycles passing other cyclists and therefore going into the auto traffic lane to do that, which, you know, is not only dangerous to the bicyclist, scares the hell out of the drivers and makes the drivers uncomfortable.
I've been known to be that guy a couple times.
Right. And then you have the hopscotch with the buses.
Yes.
Right.
Hopscotch, leapfrog.
Right.
What have you.
Yeah. So by moving the bicycle facility to the left side, you get rid of the conflict with the buses, and by making it wider and probably in most places a cycle track configuration, so there'll be some separation, whether it's, you know, a few feet of paint or a line of parked cars from the auto traffic, you make it safer. But there's the three-block section past, you know, New Seasons and Hopworks and kind of that main commercial area where the traffic engineer said, sorry, we don't have enough room to take away. If we take away the auto lane, you know, we don't have enough capacity to get all the cars through.
We got nothing.
We have to preserve that, which is going to make it less attractive to cyclists. I tend to subscribe to the weakest link theory, which is that if you have a facility, the cyclist is going to choose whether or not to use it by the least comfortable part of that. So it could be, you know, terrific for 15 blocks, but if it's dicey for 3 blocks, you might go somewhere else.
I don't want to go through Williams because it's got that narrow whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
As an example. So.
Do you want any more of this red, by the way, Chris?
No, I'm doing great with the barley wine right
Fantastic.
Now.
Fantastic. Yeah. I think I'll pour myself some because it was good. Samuel Adams Brewery, making a good beer. I am still impressed.
I'm
so happy. just out of personal curiosity, Chris, do you have a favorite place in Portland to ride? Like, I don't know, either like the most carefree or like your example of like best implementation of infrastructure or...
Probably the place I enjoy is maybe not the best implementation for infrastructure, but you know, I live in Northwest, so for most trips that I take anywhere other than downtown, I wind up using sort of the River Loop, the Tom McCall Waterfront Park and the East Bank Esplanade as kind of my big switching hub, right? Uh-huh. So I'm, even from going southeast, you know, I go across and head out Clinton or whatever, or if I'm going east, I go out, you know, one of the bikeways on Salmon or something like that. So anything that gets me along that waterfront, I really enjoy. So, you know, a lot of trips have that segment that goes along the waterfront, and that's always a lift in my day. But, you know, we did not design those as kind of efficient transportation routes. They're designed as recreational opportunities.
Yes.
So, you know, we do get conflicts between pedestrians and cyclists, between cyclists of different speeds. So they're not necessarily optimal in design, but as a place to be, they're terrific.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. I have spent some of my favorite times down there. And I think the Midnight Mystery Ride at one point arrived on.
Oh, yeah.
That was my first Midnight Mystery Ride.
Yeah, it was.
Arrived on the Esplanade at Pirates Island, I think, or something like that. Which I never even would have noticed if they hadn't stopped there. But yeah, just a wonderful little place to hang out and look at the river and be there any time of day or night. Mm-hmm. Well, unless it's a public park, in which case then it's closed officially. But I wouldn't know anything about that. Well, we're running out of time here. Is there anything else that you want to... I know you want to talk about telecommuting a little bit. And there's also...
Yeah, I think a policy that's a little bit underlooked in the comp plan. There's a policy to basically support telecommuting. I'm a telecommuter, so I'm a little bit personally biased towards this mode. I telecommute 9 days out of 10. But what I see is with the improved quality of our neighborhoods, things like co-working spaces and the quality of internet facilities that we have available, although there's also a broadband plan component to the comp plan. People have to go advocate for, I think, particularly less expensive, higher quality broadband.
I'm all for that.
Because it's, broadband is unaffordable for a big segment of our population right now.
Yeah.
So there are pieces around that. But, you know, it's an opportunity to take trips off our transportation network, particularly at peak hours. So, TriMet has a big problem around 5:30 at night, right? So if we take off only a few people because they're telecommuting, that helps the whole system quite a bit. So I hope people pay attention to that. And I think from the city side, there's a little bit of reluctance to go push that in a hard way because they tried it about 10 years ago and it wasn't super successful. But I think, so they're a little bit jaded by that. But I think now the time is a lot riper. So if we had a big push on it, and particularly if think it's probably more of an employer-led issue at this point. Mm-hmm. Employers have to give people that flexibility. Yeah. For, you know, people who are in the jobs that are about information rather than pushing atoms around.
Yeah,
I think we could get a lot more trips avoided. Even if it's only a day a week, still a big, big reduction in strain on the transportation system. So I hope people push for that. I think it's important. So I do want to do a shameless plug for one of my projects.
Please do.
This is something I'm holding called the Transit Appliance, and it's a little box. It's a single board computer that's got a Wi-Fi antenna, and when connected to any HDTV, it becomes a transit display. So you're probably all familiar with the smartphone applications that will tell you when the next bus is coming.
PDX bus, for example, which PDX I use bus, and love.
Yep, I love it as well. And you've probably all seen the shelter signs in the transit mall bus stops or MAX stops that tell you when the next vehicles are coming. So, the idea is that, not everybody has a smartphone. Not everybody's motivated to download the app and use it. So let's get this information into fixed locations that people will stumble across. So every office building lobby, every coffee shop, every bar, let's put a display that shows when the next bus is coming. So what we've done at Portland Transport, that's the nonprofit that hosts the blog that I publish.
PortlandTransport.org?
PortlandTransport.com.
.com. I think I make that mistake every time I go to Portland Transport.
Yeah, and I probably should have registered both, but I didn't back in 2005.
PortlandTransport.com. Let's say it again.
So we have basically... This is mostly a web software project, but what we've also done is figured out inexpensive hardware that will basically bring up a web browser on an HDTV.
Uh-huh.
So there's less than $50 of hardware here, although we sell it for a little bit more because we have to cover our fixed costs. But it will turn any HDTV into a transit display if you've got an internet connection, either wired or Wi-Fi. And it will show you, when the next bus is coming, the next rail line, the closest car to go vehicles. And when bike share comes up, we also expect that to have a web service. So we believe we'll be able to show you the nearest bike share location, how many bikes are available, how many empty bays to dock a bike in.
It's rolling it all into one big, awesome package.
Right. And we have no marketing budget. So I rely on earned income, earned media opportunities like this to plug it. So if you know a location that needs one of these, reach out to me and let me know.
There we go. Yeah, yeah. That's pretty fantastic and fascinating. So is it a wired device? Like you need to plug it into Ethernet, or is it? It's also available for
either
Wi-Fi?
Way. So it's got the Ethernet port there if you want to wire it. It's got the antenna if you want to use Wi-Fi.
There we go.
Works either way.
Yeah.
This works as an economic model because the bulk of the cost actually goes to the people providing the web services. So uh-huh. It's TriMet and Car2Go and Portland Streetcar that already have the web services to run the smartphone apps.
Totally.
We're just leeching off that and uh-huh. make it easy to use it and fix the displays. So.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's a really fascinating. And what's the product name again?
I call it the Transit Appliance. It probably needs a sexier name than that. That's on the project list to come up with a better name.
Well, I think the inflection in which you say the Transit Appliance and possibly a font choice like that would probably. I mean, I think that has some valid. Yeah, it tells you what it is. So
right. Yeah, it's an appliance in the sense it just has an on and off switch. There's nothing.
Right.
It's very easy to use. All the configuration happens on the web. Everything happens in the cloud. It's designed to be simple.
Yeah, well, that's very cool.
And we have about 20 of them around the community right now.
Okay. Yeah, where would we find these now?
So you'll see them in the lobbies of City Hall in the Portland building. If you go down to Bailey's Tap Room downtown on Broadway, there's one in there. The 1201 Lloyd building in the Lloyd District and several apartment buildings in South Waterfront. So.
Very good. Yep. I do like the idea that like there are some people who have smartphones but can't be bothered to mm-hmm. download the app. I mean, for someone like me who loves transit, I know I wouldn't be without it. But it is interesting that one of the hurdles people have to hop is just being interested enough to actually get into it.
And besides making it easier for the travelers who are using transit in those areas, it's also basically a big ad that says, transit is here and convenient to use.
Yeah.
So it's sort of a general plug for transit.
Yeah, which is very true. And visibility mm-hmm. makes everything a little bit more, it's to the front of people's brain lobes. Yep. Like they start, it's in their short-term access memory, their RAM, if mm-hmm. you will. I knew computers back in the day. I don't know how they work now. What was your first computer, Chris?
In high school, I programmed on a very ancient Wang machine.
Wang.
Yeah, a brand that probably went away before you were born.
Interesting. So. Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
I did AppleSoft Basic on a 2E, so okay. that was my – I've been an Apple man all my life.
Yeah, you're a little bit younger than I am.
They
PDP8, go PDP8.
That's it. Well, okay, so again, PortlandTransport.com. Anything else that you'd like to push and or pimp while you're here?
Nope. I really, really want to encourage people to turn out for the comp plan workshops and give your opinion about these issues because it's really, really important.
Yeah, there is also, as I understand, some online input submission forms as well. So if you can't be bothered to go out to an open house, there's also a way to do it from home. Excellent. Chris, thank you so much for sharing all of this stuff. I know we only scratched the surface, but that's because there's like 300 pages. So,
because
you know.
It's comprehensive.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
This is unfortunately not the comprehensive podcast. Shall we do some mail real quick?
Yeah.
All right. We got, let's see here. Any closing remarks, Chris, on the drinks that we had?
I enjoyed them both.
Yeah, they're not bad.
Good to see that breweries not only have their mass market brands, but have their passion projects as well.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, for every Levi's jeans, there's a Swerve jeans or something like that. I don't know. I'm actually I've been wearing my Swerve jeans for about a year now. I'm one of those guys who gets like a pair of shoes or a piece of clothing, and I'll wear it until it wears out.
Sure.
I'm not wearing them now, but that's because they're kind of worn out. So.
Oh, yeah. This reminds me, my Crater Lake jeans.
Oh yeah, you wore those the other day.
I wore those last night, and as I was taking them off, actually last night, they ripped.
Oh,
to beyond repair.
Like, I see.
They were pretty much held together by patches already.
But, yeah. Did they rip in a strategic location?
No, just down the leg.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe like the crotch tore out or something like that.
Well, the crotches were gone. The crotch was gone for a while.
Okay, yeah. I had this really embarrassing thing happen to me as I was just leaving college. I was helping this girl move out that I kind of liked.
Mm-hmm.
And well, I was wearing this pair of corduroy jeans that I love. They were a little bit old, a little bit worn. And as I squatted down to pick up a box to help remove, crotch failed
there it goes.
Entirely.
Nice.
And I don't know that anyone else noticed, but like I was so mortified. I was just like, I don't know these people that well. Now I have a big hole in my pants. What do I do? So I carried the box downstairs and just walked away.
Well,
didn't say goodbye. Yeah, didn't do anything. No. Just walked away.
What? I probably would have done the same.
So let me give you this.
You've got mail.
What do we have?
We've got Dan from Minnesota who sends a picture of his new Raleigh folding bicycle.
Yeah. And I think I had expressed just the idea that I had not seen the Raleigh folding bicycle, so I had no idea what it looked like. But here is a picture.
There it is.
Yeah.
Not at all like a Brompton.
No. I believe it's a two, it's like a, it folds in half or something like that.
Yeah.
As is with most historic folding bikes, the handlebars and the seat can be raised and lowered, I believe, and all that. I have two folding bikes in my garage. There's a couple that I used to ride when I was a kid that my mom sent down with me last time I was up there.
Oh, yeah.
And some of the, I think they might be broken, maybe beyond repair.
But oh.
What can you do? Let's see here. The, sorry, I should have been more on topic with this.
No worries.
Oh, here's a comment on Tracy Gayton's Piscataquis Village. One of our readers, listeners, says, I too have been traumatized by growing up in a Florida suburban nightmare. Tampa was a hot mess of sprawl and many malls. So he says, best of luck on the project. And let's see here. There's one more. This is where I'm going to edit out some of that silence. Is it not even here? Oh, here it is. Oh, okay. Johnny K, he left a comment as well saying, St. Augustine is in Florida. That's where he lives. He wishes that Jacksonville, Florida. Oh, never mind. He doesn't live there. He lives in Jacksonville. Wishes it had something like Velocol. Apparently, Burrow Bags has a sister company, Burrow Bar. So Burrow Bags makes bags to carry stuff in.
Ah, right.
And next door, they also have a bar, which is it's kind of like Velocol, except it's not a full-on bike shop. But
it's just bags.
Yeah, but I mean, any place you can get alcohol, I think, you know, why not? It's so much. It's the positive income for the loss leader business.
Good
really.
Point. Yeah. Good point. Friend of mine back in Michigan talked about a laundromat he used to go to way, way back in the 70s.
In Michigan?
That had an attached bar.
Okay.
You go, you do your laundry, and then you just step through these doors, have a few drinks while you're...
Because what else are you going to do? Yeah.
I think I remember one of those is called Suds and Duds.
Okay. There we go. Yeah. And up in Seattle, just... I think it had just closed when I went up looking for it, but I believe it was called Spin Cycle, and it was also, yeah, laundromat attached bar.
Right.
Jonah Kay also said that going touring without maps, I think he was touching off of our conversation with Sky about just kind of going out into the woods, oh, yeah. You know, and he recommends adventurecycling.org, which of course, those are the maps I used for our last summer trip. Right. I have mixed feelings about adventure cycling because a lot of it is highway riding and I love getting off of the highway and into some, you know, more obscure roads. But at the same time, adventure cycling has some great stuff and fairly current information on where to get food and every other thing that you need while you're on the road with a bike. And cyclocamping.com. He doesn't work for either of these, but he does like them a lot. So we'll put those links up right on the website. So, hey, without further ado, that is the end of our show.
Adieu.
Let us get the ending music and we'll be done.
Sure.
All right.
Upcoming shows.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Throw them out there real quick.
Next week already. Yeah. On the 17th, Ellie Blue and Martina Farner on Women in the Cycling Industry. On the 24th, Jonathan Miles from Bike Portland. And the 3rd is Mickey Blizzard, the Freeway Slayer.
That's right. And former associate of Earl Blumenauer.
Right on. And then on the 10th, Michael Anderson from Portland Afoot.
Yeah. And we're actually, Chris, I believe you were on the podcast with Michael talking about what do you do when you visit relatives and they have car-dependent lives, you do not. How do you deal with that? So that was such a fascinating conversation. I said, Michael, let's do some more talking about that. So we're going to talk about that. All right. This is the very end.
The end of all things.
That's right.
Find us on the internet at thesprocketpodcast.com. Send feedback about the program and suggestions for topics and or guests and or drinks. Write us via email. The address is thesprocketpodcast@gmail.com. Or call and leave us a message at 503-847-9774. Connect with us on Twitter at Sprocket Podcast. Thanks to Ryan J. Lane for providing our theme music. Find him on the internet at ryanjlane.bandcamp.com. Thanks to Hurtbird for our headline sounder. Find them at hurtbirdmusic.com. Yeah.
And as Mark Maron would say, Boomy lives! See everybody next week. Bye.
Hello.
Hey, Colin, how are you?
Not too bad, Brock. How about yourself?
I'm doing great. Glad we get to finally talk.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for making the time.
No worries at all. So what is it you're curious about exactly? Just around the podcast host itself? Or?
Yeah. Well, maybe we can take this time to introduce you to the audience, just saying you are the proprietor of thepodcasthost.com, which is our new hosting server. And how long has it been around?
It's been around about 3 years, I think, now.
Okay.
My background's in web design, so I've been a web designer, web developer for years now. I teach as well at a university. So I teach people how to do podcasting. And that's kind of how it came about, actually, just because I used to use other podcast hosts and basically they just... I don't know, there was always something not quite right, or the service wasn't quite there, or there was always just a few things that just didn't quite satisfy me, so I thought I'd just have a go at doing it myself, basically. So I've been doing that for the last 3 years or so, alongside a bit of, still doing a bit of web design, web development as well.
Yeah, and one of the big complaints, the reason we moved from our last server was that basically whenever things hit the fan, whenever there was a problem, and, you know, whenever something came up, no one was around to answer the call. There was no way to get in touch. Emails were responded to. Basically, like if the email was responded to, it was, you know, there's nothing wrong, or we have fixed the problem, or you should be happy for what you're getting. And of course, nothing was further from the truth. So we have been remarkably pleased with your service. So thank you very much.
Well, that's no problem. I think that was the thing that always got me as well. And do you know what? We're still quite small with the podcast host as well, because I tend to be a bit too honest sometimes and just admit when stuff's gone wrong, or just sort of tell people what has gone wrong. And possibly it doesn't work that well with some people, but most people seem to appreciate it. So yeah, I'm going to keep doing that and never mind what happens.
Yeah. So do you have your own podcast? Are you a program producer or are you kind of on the teaching end of things?
I have produced podcasts in the past. I've done a few around education, so I've done some around actually making podcasts. I've done some just around sort of teaching and how to get better at teaching as well. I've experimented with I know your topic's all about biking, and I'm a really keen mountain biker as well, and I've experimented with a few mountain biking podcasts in the past, but they've never quite worked out. So I tend to just be a teacher these days.
Very good. So tell me about mountain biking. How did you first get involved?
Oh, I've been mountain biking since I was about, I probably came to a bit late, actually. I'm 33 these days, the aging 33. But back in my 20s, I was taken along to Glen Tress, which is one of the most popular trails in Scotland, by one of my pals. And I was taken down the Red Run, which is, do you guys have sort of color grades over in America as well?
I believe so. I don't know whole lot about mountain biking myself. I like the idea, but I've never done much of it, so I assume so.
It's same as the skiing, to be honest. The Reds is a second hardest lot. So I was taking down that, not having a scooby what I was doing, on a bike that I got when I was 16. So it was an old hardtail, no suspension or anything, down this ridiculously hard trail. And I hated every single minute of it. So I vowed I wasn't going to go back again.
Yeah.
But I was dragged along again a few weeks later by the same friend. And actually, I just started to get into it, and I've loved it ever since. And it's kind of, that's what I do to blow off steam and to enjoy my weekends. So I'm out of it at the moment because I broke my leg about 6 months back.
Oh man!
So I'm trying to get back into it just now. I'm just getting the training up and getting the leg strong again. So I'm dying to get out there again. But soon.
It's a little bit of a setback, but I assume how far along in the healing process are you?
Pretty much there, almost there. Still a wee bit sore, but I'm ready to get out again.
So, time to test your strength. Yeah. Was this? Did you hurt yourself while you were mountain biking?
No, it was actually, ironically, it was I do some pretty hairy stuff on the mountain bike, but it was when I was just cycling to work.
Okay, so, well, there we go.
Yeah. I came off just cycling along the road.
How far is your cycle commute?
Not far, actually, only about 20 minutes.
Nice, so, that's not so bad.
Yeah. I live pretty close to work, so that's quite nice.
Yeah, and you're in Edinburgh, is that right?
That's right, yep. I live just outside the sort of city limits of Edinburgh, and I cycle just inside Edinburgh to get to work.
Okay. Is cycling kind of normative there, or are you one of the odd people out?
It's getting more popular over here for commuting. You definitely see a lot more of the luminous jackets these days cycling about. But we're still lagging way behind a lot of the European countries. Like in the UK in general, we haven't got the sort of the infrastructure for it. We've not got the bike lanes or the sort of promotion of it and all that kind of stuff. It's just there's a lot that could be done to make people do a lot more biking, I'd say.
Yeah, so it's still kind of in the cowboy phase then.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Well, very good. I will. I'll probably cut ourselves off. We should have you on again to talk about mountain biking a little bit more, because that's
anytime, bro.
Yeah, it's a thing that we haven't really covered in the justice that it deserves, because there's a bunch of adventures to be had out there. But
yeah.
Well, cool. Thanks again for making time.
Yeah, no worries at all. Do you have a lot of interest? Do you have a lot of listeners that do mountain biking, or is it mostly a sort of road biking audience you've got?
I think, by and large, the most of the stuff that we have done has been oriented around road touring, just because that's kind of what I do. It's what I'm most excited about. And so having done that, that was where we started from. But I'm kind of interested just in, like, carless life in general. We do a lot of talk about transit. We do a lot of talk about other things from time to time. Mountain biking is one of those things that it's kind of a tricky nut to crack, just because there are so many ways to do it that require a car. Portland has so much potential, but it also has so little access. It's one of the things we just actually talked about with our last interview that we aired this last week, was a guy who had done a lot of mountain biking, both touring and just kind of recreationally. And he was bemoaning that here in Portland, Oregon, there's just not too much access. And I think it'll get better, but it's still definitely on the way, and not all the way here yet.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, actually. It's one of the reasons I moved just outside the city, actually. I lived in Edinburgh, actually, inside the city for the last 13 years, and I've just moved out because I got fed up with having to drive out to Glentress. So now I can go out my door, I can pick up my bike at the garage, and I can be in the hills within about sort of 7 or 8 minutes, I would say.
Oh, that's
huge benefits of being where I am.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Very good.
So, yeah.
Well, hey, I know it's late where you are, so I'll let you go. But thanks again. Really appreciate the service. And again, it's been top notch. Like, this is head and shoulders above anything else that I think we could have found. So,
well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
You're like the boutique shop of podcast hosting.
Cheers, Brock. I'll try to live up to that in future.
Have a good night, man.
Okay. Cheers. You too.
Bye bye.
Thanks.